Welcome, everybody, here to the Unplugged podcast. Here we have Dr. Petros Grivas, worldwide leader in GU Oncology, a great friend, a great mentor, and somebody that really helps out a lot of people. So great to see you, Petros.
Great to see you, Chandler. What a fantastic GU 2025 ASCO symposium. Really enjoyed it. Great data sets. Great to see many friends and colleagues. And really impressive to see the field moving forward so impressively and so fast.
Oh, absolutely. I was teasing some of the people at ASCO GU. It's just we're at the golden age in terms of GU, but specifically urothelial cancers. The data that was there this year and also coming up is phenomenal, especially in the localized setting, Petros.
Absolutely. It's impressive. And, you know, very quickly, Chandler, I'm just going to lay a few thoughts here for us to think about. As you pointed out, it's impressive the pace, how quickly we acquire knowledge and data. And we saw updates from the Niagara trial. This was a phase 3 trial evaluating the addition of durvalumab perioperatively together with GemCis as neoadjuvant therapy, followed by radical surgery, and then up to 8 monthly adjuvant doses of durvalumab. And Niagara trial was presented at the ESMO 2024 meeting. And this was, in my opinion, practice-changing, paradigm-shifting data. Of course, there are many caveats and limitations in that study. For example, very few, if any, patients in the control arm of the neoadjuvant GemCis alone, very few, if any, patients had access to adjuvant checkpoint inhibition. And also, it's questionable how many patients had access to salvage rescue therapies in metastatic disease. And those parameters can, of course, impact the performance of the control group, and they may have contributed to the results of the study. At the same time, we cannot tease out the contribution of the neoadjuvant component and the adjuvant component. Do you need either or both based on the design of the study? And of course, this was designed many years ago. And kudos to the investigators for doing that Niagara trial, no doubt. It's just inherently difficult to tease apart the contribution of each of the therapy phase, neoadjuvant, adjuvant unit, either or both. Having said that, I think overall it's a practice-changing study. We saw some interesting data, and I say that, by the way, because of the event-free survival and overall survival benefit with the addition of durvalumab perioperatively to the neoadjuvant GemCis. The data that we saw at ASCO GU 2025 were interesting because they broke down the EFS and OS data based on the pathologic states. Pathologic complete response and no pathologic complete response. And of course, you can argue that, you know, these are subsets maybe underpowered, exploratory ad hoc analysis, not definitive for each of the subsets. But qualitatively, you can say that the benefit with durvalumab appears to be in both subsets, both patients with pathologic complete response and those with not achieving pathologic complete response. So I think it's interesting to see, again, based on the exploratory nature of this analysis, that the benefit might be in both populations. The problem is there may be risk for over-treatment and under-treatment, and in the absence of reliable, accurate biomarkers, for example, ctDNA integrated to the pathologic state, it's hard for us to know which patients really need the adjuvant component. So it's a discussion with the patient, I think, about pros and cons, and someone can look at the curves and the absolute difference, and again, discussing with the patient, making informed decisions in a shared decision-making model. But at least it was interesting to see this breakdown of the Kaplan-Meier curve for EFS and OS in the path CR and non-path CR subset. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I know that, you know, at the ESMO last year with Tom Powles giving an outstanding presentation, and I love your discussion after the presentation. And, you know, the top line data at the time, event-free survival at 24 months, 67.8% for durvalumab versus with the chemo versus 52.8 for the control group, which is CIS-GEM. And then to build on that, I know that Dr. Galsky mentioned, what about the patients that had PCR versus non-PCR? And this is controversial. I know that back in the day when they did the 2003 New England Journal with neoadjuvant chemo, the question was that an ITT population? This is an ITT population. So then the question is that PCR comparable to the PCR in the past? Because if you look at some of the PCR with the docetaxel, it seems higher, but it's, I know some people are saying it's comparing apples to oranges. And then the definition of PCR, I mean, some people say it's less than T1. Some people say it has to be T0. And that's why we need leaders like yourself, Petros, to kind of come up with some kind of systemic kind of like a definition of PCR. But in the study, I think the top line that what I noticed is whether the patients received PCR or not received PCR, there was overall survival in both arms, whether with a hazard ratio, it looks like in the overall survival in the pathological complete response of 0.72, and the non-pathological complete response patients, it was 0.84. So they're both statistically significant. And then if you look at the event-free survival in the comparative arm is 0.58 for patients that receive PCR, and the patients that do not receive PCR, it was 0.77. So what does it seem like to me? It seems like whether the patients receive PCR or not PCR, there seems to be a benefit of chemoimmunotherapy. But my question is, does the adjuvant immunotherapy add much? And that's something we need kind of leaders like yourself, Petros, to help us.
Yeah, it's a great discussion, Chandler. You know, looking at the data, as you said, it's hard to tease out those details because the difference in terms of the hazard ratio, numerically, they're maybe slightly different. But if you look at the confidence interval, there is overlap in terms of the degree of benefit in the PathCR and the non-PathCR subset. So it's hard to tell, you know, whether this hazard ratio is a meaningful difference between the two subsets. Having said that, there is a hypothesis there. You know, there is a signal that maybe the patients with pathologic complete response potentially may have higher degree of benefit. It's just hard to tell based on the sample size and the exploratory nature of the subset analysis, and of course the power that goes with each of the subset. But to your point, I think right now, you know, we're facing decision making for individual patients in the clinic. And as you said, you know, it's hard to know exactly which patient really needs the adjuvant therapy component. If someone has already pathological complete response, we will know that the chance of potential cure is very high, and the absolute difference in terms of the EFS and OS benefit is numerically in the absolute difference probably small because people do better in the PathCR. Having said that, there may still be some benefit in some patients, even with the PathCR subset. So we're having trouble, again, predicting who may be relapsing. So that's where I think the maybe ctDNA data in the plasma may be helpful to help inform this debate and dialogue. And we encourage, you know, the sponsor of the Niagara trial to show us data and integrate circulating tumor DNA in the plasma with the pathologic states. Again, help us as much as possible prognosticate on the, you know, in patients and see how much, in terms of a hypothesis, benefit we get with adjuvant Durva in those patients. So I think it's an open question. I don't think we know all the answers yet, but I think for sure the data we saw at ASCO 2025 helps inform the dialogue with the patient, both in the pathological complete response and the non-pathological complete response subset. And again, for the moment, with all the caveats, limitations, and imperfections, it seems to be a hypothesis that durvalumab may benefit to some degree both subsets.
Oh, I agree. And I think some of the data that's going to be reading out in the future, you mentioned like the ctDNA, you know, in the InVigor 11 that Dr. Powell's, I mean, it's close. So we're just kind of waiting for the data on that. I know the Volga study, they had some ctDNA, which was a little bit different than with the Signatera and Natera. So I think that's kind of interesting. And then also at ASCO GU, with the whole neoadjuvant space, when you have the HER2 targeted with PD inhibition, I mean, this still has to be replicated in a larger study, but like, I thought the PCR was like, what, 60-some percent, which is remarkable. And then we're still waiting for EV Pembro in a neoadjuvant state. So this PCR, the question is, Petros, for our patient care, once we get this PCR and the neoadjuvant localized, do you foresee a period where they do a cystoscopy and they don't see anything? Do we really need a cystectomy? I don't know. I know that's kind of controversial, Petros. What are your thoughts in the future if the PCR rates keep going higher and higher based on personalized medicine in the neoadjuvant setting?
It's a great question, Chandler. You know, as we see data with higher pathological complete response rates, you know, with future regimens, as of note, we'll do a separate discussion together about our very interesting poster with one of our junior faculty, Dr. Ray Chowdhury. We look at dostensenvac plus pembrolizumab as only neoadjuvant therapy for massive invasive bladder cancer with histological variant subtypes. And we saw an impressive pathological complete response rate with chemoimmunotherapy approaching 60%, which is very promising. And we'll talk more about that in a different discussion later today. But to your point, you know, if Ipembro in the Keynote B15, Keynote 905, and also EV with Durva plus minus Tremi in the Volga trial, if those come with a very high pathological complete response in that range, this, I think, reinforces the question, do we need to do cystectomies, radical cystectomy, lymph node dissection of those patients? And again, the same question applies. Can we integrate ctDNA as a potential tool, as a potential biomarker to help co-inform, co-influence this discussion, help us tease out which patients might potentially be cured with systemic therapy alone, and therefore potentially avoiding local regional therapy, radiation, chemotherapy, or radical cystectomy in those patients as consolidation approaches. I think this is where the field is going, and I think we need more data with these bladder preservation trials. I think our enthusiasm goes up, and I think in the future, with better effective systemic therapies, achieving higher PAD CRH and probably clinical complete response rates, and again, with the utilization of tools, maybe some composite biomarkers, ctDNA in the plasma, cystoscopy mapping biopsies, maybe multiparametric MRIs and/or CTs, maybe we can, you know, potentially in the future, built upon, you know, the Hoosier Cancer Research Network trial by Matt Galsky that used Gemcis Nivo, and try to build upon that trial and identify patients who may be cured potentially with systemic therapy alone. We are getting to that direction. The data hopefully will build up in the future. We're not there yet in terms of the comfort on predicting at the individual patient level, but that's where the field is going, and we need to do more trials and build upon the great momentum.
Absolutely. And you know, when we have the positive studies, we're all excited, clapping hands, but, you know, sometimes the negative studies we learn from as well. And also, you know, sometimes the shiniest new toy is not necessarily the best toy. There's also other things that we have to keep an eye on, like for instance, like your docetaxel, the study that you're doing with your mentees. And I mean, I still use docetaxel in a neoadjuvant state. You know, you check that echo, make sure that ejection fraction is good. But, you know, there's some patients that, and plus it's 56 days of chemo versus 84. So I still think there's a role there for neoadjuvant docetaxel. So I'm glad you're doing this not only in the variant histology, but I think you're doing it in a regular patient population as well. Is that right?
That's a great question. And definitely, you know, I'm looking forward to the future here. But I'm trying to synthesize the data from the Niagara trial, which, again, with the caveats we discussed before, our practice changing. We're waiting to see what the regulatory agencies will do with the Niagara data. I think both you and me would agree that it's very likely for this agent to be approved in the perioperative setting. The big question is, what do you do in the clinic? And, you know, if you synthesize that data from Niagara, as well as the data that from our study that we presented at ASCO GU a few days ago, with docetaxel VAC plus pembrolizumab, and also in the context of the AURA trial, AURA trial from Europe with docetaxel VAC and avelumab, I think overall, I have enthusiasm about the idea of docetaxel VAC plus checkpoint inhibition. I think you need both chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibition in the neoadjuvant setting. And then the question is, what do you need adjuvantly, again, based on the dialogue we just had before? And for now, probably durvalumab may be given in both settings. But personally, I think you need both chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibition in those who are fit enough to get that combination neoadjuvantly. And I'm compelled, again, without phase 3 data to back it up, I'm compelled enough to say I would consider those docetaxel plus checkpoint inhibitor as my neoadjuvant strategy. I think that's a big discussion, you know, what the FDA will do. Will they approve Gem-Cis durvalumab just based on the Niagara data? Probably. Or they will take an approach of cisplatin-based chemotherapy plus durvalumab. And that will be an interesting discussion. But we'll see what happens in the near future, my friend.
Absolutely. And you know, Andrew Apollo with the Ambassador study and Galsky with the CheckMate 274. So it gives you a time point where, you know, after you do surgery, you can see if they have a PD-L, because the data for the PD-L patient population is much higher there. You can see if they have a PCR. So it gives leaders like yourself and Galsky and Apollo an opportunity to look at it and say, okay, where do we go from here? Now, only tricky part is, you know, a lot of the general oncologists in America, unfortunately, they treat every cancer under the sun. And so I know, talking to the practicality of things, they kind of like to have it, if it's FDA approved, you know, Niagara, set it and forget it. you know, you do the neoadjuvant chemotherapy, chemoimmunotherapy, and then adjuvant. But I think the data is that we have to kind of look more deeply into this, because this is not a slam dunk. And so that's why by doing newer studies, like you're saying, I think adds a lot, you know, ctDNA, right? If they have a PCR, do they really need no treatment? Maybe we can do like the Sunrise study there and do like a localized treatment, because, you know, the Sunrise 2 was a negative study, you know, with the muscle invasive was a negative study, but the Sunrise 3 looks kind of interesting there. Maybe you can do it after they get PCR. I feel like there's so much research. It just adds more questions. And when you have passionate people like yourself, it makes you think, okay, what does this mean? What can we do to help our patient care? So that's what I love about the field, Petros. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's exciting to see the plethora of trials, as you mentioned. You know, we had, you know, back in the day, I remember 10, 15 years ago, the debate was those Dostenvac versus GemCis neoadjuvant therapy. The debate still continues, as we saw at ASCO GU a few days ago. It's interesting to see that, but that's in the different context. It's in the context of combining chemotherapy with checkpoint inhibition, again, in patients who can tolerate that, which is a vast majority of patients can get checkpoint inhibition in the neoadjuvant setting. And that combination may potentially target more of the tumor heterogeneity, right? Some tumors may respond more to chemotherapy, some others to checkpoint inhibition. If you add them together, you may capture more of the tumor clones and tumor heterogeneity, and that may translate in numerically higher pathological complete response rate. Is that enough? Do you need also the adjuvant component? Hard to tell, but you might need both, at least in some patients. It's just hard to predict on the individual patient level. But you pointed out Ambassador trial by Dr. Apollo and colleagues. We published this at the New England Journal of Medicine in September 2024, the CheckMate 274 trial that were presented before the data by Dr. Galsi, Dr. Bajori, and we saw updates just a few days ago by Dr. Milowski and team on CheckMate 74 with adjuvant nivo versus placebo. A very important trial, also practice changing, because it led to the approval of adjuvant nivolumab in a purely adjuvant setting. And then you have, you know, ongoing trials that are pending results, and we're waiting to review those trials. For example, the GemCis plus minus Pembro, GemCis plus minus Nivo, KEYNOTE-B15, KEY-905, and of course, Volga trial. And of course, you know, there's some interesting data sets that we saw at ESMO a few months ago in 2024, like the Tombola trial, and looking at ctDNA in the adjuvant setting, the Sunrise 4 trial with neoadjuvant TAR-200, intravesical and centrelimab, interesting studies. And of course, the ongoing trials, IMvigor011 and modern trial, IMvigor011 evaluating ctDNA, randomizes patients to adjuvant atezolizumab or placebo if they're ctDNA positive. And of course, the modern trial with Dr. Galsi and the Alliance group in the US, looking at two different questions, escalation, de-escalation, based on ctDNA in the purely adjuvant setting. All those trials will co-define the future. And as you pointed out before, Chandler, the interest is, of course, in optimizing neoadjuvant adjuvant therapy, but even more, can we think about selecting better our patients for bladder preservations? Which patients can be cured with systemic therapy alone? I'm very excited about this question.
Oh, and patients love it. I know you and I, we have a passion for people and just caring about our patients. And that would be the goal that we want. And so I'm excited about this. But, you know, I tell you, Petros, if you think about it, like, was it 2016, 17, we had the atezolizumab, and then you had the pembrolizumab in a metastatic setting. And before that, if you look at the timeline, it was like cisgem. But like in the last 9 years, not just in the metastatic setting, but the localized setting, it's like the knowledge and the studies of like, what are your thoughts about that, Petros, in the last 9 years with the atezolizumab FDA approved in the metastatic setting?
There has been a complete evolution and quote-unquote revolution in the field of bladder cancer. I can share with you, Chandler, in 2012, I was presenting as a fellow at that time. This was 13 years ago, a randomized phase 2 trial in the metastatic setting. At that time, we looked at sunitinib as switch maintenance after platinum-based chemotherapy, and this was a negative trial. There was no difference with switch maintenance sunitinib at the time after platinum-based chemotherapy. This was done with my mentor at the time, Dr. Hussein, back in the University of Michigan. Time flies, again, 2012. And, you know, when I was presenting the trial data as an oral presentation, the room was kind of, you can argue semi-full or semi-empty, depending on how you see the glass, right? Half full, half empty. And I was wondering why, it's not full. It's like a randomized phase two trial. We need, to see the data. And fast forward years later, you cannot find an empty seat, right? It's a packed room, standing only. Just shows you how many miles ahead we are now, how much more interest everybody has in the field of bladder cancer, how much we're helping our patients. I remember, to your point, Chandler, in May 2016, when the first checkpoint inhibitor in metastatic urothelial carcinoma, atezolizumab, at the time was FDA approved. It was, again, the day of a new era, and this era keeps evolving, and we have now many checkpoint inhibitors. We have antibody drug conjugates. Of course, we have targeted therapy with erdafitinib for FGFR3 susceptible alterations. The field has been transformed, and I think we'll keep being transformed, I think, with all these interesting combinations and, of course, the development of new regimens, new mechanisms of actions and biomarkers. So there has definitely been a huge change in the field, much more attention, much more investment in the field of bladder cancer, translating to better outcomes for our patients, much more involvement by patient advocacy groups, the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, the World Bladder Cancer Patient Coalition, and many other advocacy groups. All together, I think we're helping or playing a role as a team, as a global team, to move the field forward and help our patients.
Oh, wonderful. I love what you mentioned, man. I think, just talking to Thomas Flagg, he's been to every ASCO GU, and I asked him about the evolution of the ASCO GU meeting. And the very first meeting, it was just maybe oncologists, right? But then you had, the patient and advocacy groups. Then you had the industry, sponsors. Then you had the fellows. And now, we're at the point where it's like a team, and the ASCO GU has just gone straight up. And we're, attracting the brightest minds into ASCO GU, which just keeps the momentum keeps going higher and higher. I think it's phenomenal, Petros.
It is phenomenal, my friend. And I look forward, to the future where we can cure all patients. That will be an ideal dream, a vision for the future. We're not there yet, but I think we're all working very hard for this to happen. And again, it takes a village, right? It takes multiple stakeholders. It takes a laboratory-based investigators. It takes clinical investigators, translational scientists, of course, patients, their families, advocates, statisticians, regulatory bodies, multiple different, stakeholders are part of this evolving field. And I think, meetings like ASCO, the symposia, ASCO GU, and many other meetings, I think are helping getting us together, think together, asking questions to each other, try to challenge ourselves. Yes. And I think that challenge can translate to better studies and better outcomes for the patients.